everybody. I'm Craig Eastman from theoneliner.com, coming to you tonight from the banks of the ever mucky Mersey River in Glasgow. We have site designer, editor, general overlord Scott Morris.
Hello.
And in sunny Falkirk, we have site contributor Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Tonight we're going to be talking about the films on general release in the UK, the top 10 from the 26th to the 28th of October. So without further ado, let's get cracking on. Number 10, we have Sicko. Someone fill us in.
Well, basically it's Michael Moore versus health insurance. It's
Go health insurance.
Well, it's by the end of the film, it's probably a position you'll want to take. Apparently, America seems a very strange attitude to national health service that we enjoy in this country, and for whatever reason, it's decided it's some kind of red communist scheme to keep people healthy. I don't know why. Basically, it's a film where Michael Moore wanders around Europe, marvelling at this free healthcare service that we all enjoy so much, and wondering why can't America do something the same with the usual Moorean selective reporting and soppy emotional manipulation.
Well, this is the thing now, isn't it, with Sicko, is that for a while now people have been speculating on the quality of Moore's reportage, and just recently seems to have been taking a lot of flack, and it's now widely acknowledged that basically he just makes a lot of stuff up, doesn't he?
No, I don't think it's so much that. It's a way of... But exactly the same thing that politicians do that he gets so upset about. He's just picking the bits of data that he likes and ignoring some other bits that he doesn't. I mean, if you watch, there's a section of this where he's going around a UK hospital and asking everyone to meet so it's free then, and you don't have to pay. It's free. You don't have to pay. Free. Wow, it's free. So it's free then. Free. Free. And if one person manages to sort of crowbar in, well, there's national insurance, and to which he responds, but it's free. Yes, free. And he kind of makes this kind of crazy halcyon vision where money just falls from trees and lands in hospitals and pays for everything, rather than actually presenting the point that, I mean, I don't mind paying national insurance. I think it's very well worthwhile putting a pittance that we pay for it to have a health service there. But he doesn't even mention that.
Drew, you've always quite enjoyed reading some of Michael Moore's written works and things, and I know you've enjoyed some of his earlier documentaries. Where do you stand on Sicko? Are you more sceptical now than you may have been previously? Or?
Yes, and also it's a topic I know quite a lot about, obviously. But more it's like revisiting Moore's stuff. I mean, still, some of the things he's done, although not so much in Sicko, he's still funny, and he still often has a very good point. He just tends to undermine it by his own actions.
Well, this is it. For me, Michael Moore seems to be more of an emotional documentary maker, and that may seem a bit oxymoronic because surely that sort of thing, you know, documentary should be as objective as possible. But he tends to wallow in sentimentality a bit too much, doesn't he, and a bit of hyperbole here and there.
He's a populist, so you kind of expect that. The problem is that he doesn't seem to know when to stop.
No, he doesn't know when to put the brakes on, does he?
He makes these films with valid points, right? But then, like, at the end of Fahrenheit 9/11 with that stupid crying woman, like, you just start to hate
him. Lila Lipscomb, if I remember correctly.
And you just feel like, yeah, you're ruining yourself. He's undoing all his good work by saying, like, here's a good issue. People should think about this, ask some questions, and then just throws in some stupid thing or something that's misrepresented. Mm. So you start to doubt everything else he said.
I heard an interview recently with and in typical fashion for myself, I can't back any of this up with paperwork because I can't even remember the fella's name. One politician or another who had been involved somewhere along the line, and Fahrenheit 9/11, Moore had made a point of, oh, yeah, he won't give us an interview, blah, blah, blah. And this politician is quite open about the fact, I'm not sure what he's talking about. He was in touch with my people. I said, yep, he can have an interview on any of these days here, at any of these available times. He said, I'm a politician, I can't just drop everything just to talk to a documentary maker. But I did give him a big list, he said, about 2 pages long of available slots where I could have spoken to him, and he chose not to come to speak to me. And the next thing I know, I'm watching this documentary, and there he is bad-mouthing me, saying, he wouldn't give us an interview, he wouldn't give us an interview. Surely that's unacceptable. Can we have any faith at all anymore in what Michael Moore tries to tell us on film?
Well, I think the thing, you have to stop thinking of it as a documentarian when it's quite clear that he's not and he's just doing some kind of op-ed piece. And there's been numerous incidents like that. There was another famous one during Roger and Me where he could quite easily have got interviews with the head of GM and pretty much chose not to because it's a better story if he doesn't. It gives him something to rail against.
Exactly.
like I said, I mean, he's a populist, and he's largely doing the same sort of thing that people like Fox News do. It's just from the other side, which makes him just as bad, although possibly not quite as wrong as they are.
So as a populist piece of entertainment, then, is Sickle worth your £7 entrance fee?
Oh, Lord, no. It's no. A good at least half hour too long.
Easily.
I mean, the structure of it, basically, he goes up, after a bit of introduction to the thing, he goes up to Canada and goes around their health service, then he goes to the UK and goes around their health service, then he goes to France and goes around their health service. All three of those sections are like about at least half an hour long or something, and could easily just be cut down to one of them without damaging the film in any way, shape or form. And it's so damn boring by the end of the film that you just really don't want to see any more of it.
Especially the French bit. While France clearly has the best system, by the time he's gotten to France, he's already done Britain and Canada, and the French bit's the longest bit. This is just sounding very, very familiar. There are two other real problems with it. One is simply from why it won't work as a piece of entertainment or even an eye-opening thing in Britain, is that we have the National Health Service. Everybody knows it's a great idea, even if it doesn't work particularly well.
Even if the implementation may be a little bit poor at the moment.
Yes. Nobody wants to give up. Everybody realises the benefit of it and why it's a thing to be proud of. So there's not, as a British audience, you're not really thinking, oh, I really wish we had one of those or anything.
And the other no mention of MRSA then.
No.
Sorry, you were saying the other problem before I really interrupted you.
Yeah, the other problem is, other than the fact that it's far too long, is that he doesn't really present any answers. Or if he can't do it himself, doesn't speak to anybody who could present any answers to how America could sort the health system. It's kind of a major failing.
It's more a lot of conjecture than actually any sort of reasonable discussion.
It's pointing at some quite horrific stories that, if they're true, are just beyond the pale. They're deeply unpleasant, and certainly if an American is watching it, realises what a bad state they're in, perhaps they're prompted to ask more questions with people in power. Whether it could have any effect or not, I'm a bit dubious, but you know, it might prompt people to ask appropriate questions. But it didn't speak to anybody suggesting, well, perhaps this might work in America, or this is broken, here's a way we might do it. It just doesn't present any answers. It kind of ends the film being, oh, but that was largely pointless. Well done, Mr. Moore.
Yeah, I think it's, especially for a European audience, it's completely irrelevant. We're already sold on the idea. We don't need to preach it to us, and I think that's reflected in its box office figures, where it's pretty much died on its ass.
This is it, isn't it? With something like Fahrenheit 9/11 or Bowling for Columbine, although the focus may be on American issues, it's something which is of global interest, whereas Sickle is pretty much just US-centric, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, not one for a global audience.
No, again, just because it doesn't really present any answers, and because quite so many people have had these experiences and either have no health insurance or have been stiffed by the insurance companies in America, most people probably know this anyway. So if it provides some answers, then I can see the point. But even for an American audience, I'm not sure it has an awful lot of point.
Yeah. Okay, then, so not one that we're going to recommend off the cuff or anything like that. Number 9, Dark is Rising. Someone fill us in.
It's a teen-orientated sub-Tolkien, sub-C.S. Lewis, possibly sub-J.K. Rowling mismatch of ideas from umpteen fantasy sources, where following a fairly standard genotype of a young boy, discovers he has magical powers to do this, that, and the other, and become a powerful weapon for the forces of light against the force of darkness, and yada 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 yada.
This is a literary adaptation from yet another series of Pretenders to the Throne novels, isn't it?
I believe so. I for some reason haven't read it. Can make your own things up for that.
We can imagine several reasons.
I can defend this somewhat in that for its target audience, which is your tweenage kind of kids, it's does what it needs to do. Fair enough. It tells a very simple sort of coming of age kind of story where this young boy Will Stanton has to go and find 5 MacGuffins to save the world, and it kind of works. There's moments where it's quite fun, but for the most part, it's kind of dull, to be honest with you.
Really, Drew, have you seen this one?
I have, yes. And I would say that it's pretty much all dull. I didn't like it at all.
I mean, I don't know. There's a couple of things to like. I mean, it's got Christopher Eccleston as the force of darkness. Now, when he's actually being his full-on evil self, he's basically used entirely as a plot exposition device and is basically telling other people what to do and where to go and sounds so bored, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, his performance in those parts is on a par with Nick Cage and Ghost Rider.
It's pretty dismal stuff, but then again, there's the odd bit where he gets to cut loose a bit, and when he's kind of being undercover, where he's basically more or less being Doctor Who, which is actually quite a lot of fun, and the kind of sort of wacky, grainy, gurning at the camera kind of thing. That works quite well. And the forces of light are helped by having Lovejoy on their side, so it was good to see Ian McShane back in the saddle. And
oh, excellent stuff. Oh, we always love a bit of Ian McShane around here, if we need our antiques evaluating or anything like that.
I couldn't really see why it would appeal even to its target audience, because nothing happens.
Well, this is what I was going to ask then. I mean, obviously, being old and geriatric like ourselves, maybe we've lost our appreciation for that sort of thing, but can you imagine it being fun and worthwhile for its target audience? Drew, I take it from your comments.
I cannot imagine where its target audience that I would have enjoyed it.
Scott, what are your feelings?
To be honest, I think if you're in that kind of tweeny age, I think you'll be entertained well enough by it that you won't feel cheated by it. I mean, I don't think it's a bad film. There's far worse. There's more egregious things that you could be watching.
But here's the thing, Harry Potter aside, the tweenies really want anything other than violence and gore these days.
Possibly, I don't know.
Surely not.
Yeah. Seem to like Ratatouille, I don't know.
Tweenies seem to like Ratatouille.
Compare it to something like was it Stormbreaker, the Alex Rider film, which got to be the same sort of target audience, but it had far more fun, a greater element of fun, far more action, and a third of its running time than The Darkest Rise managed in its entire 90 minutes.
Yeah. Mm. Should also note that film also died on its ass, though. So
yes,
perhaps what we think isn't particularly important in that scene.
Should perhaps imagine not. At number eight, we have a film that just is beginning to grate a bit now because it just won't leave the top. I'm not saying it's terrible, but it won't leave the top 10. Run, Fat Boy, Run.
Yeah, I mean, we've already covered Run, Fat Boy, Run. I think it's an acceptable enough but fairly unremarkable comedy, but what surprised me is it's still here and taking over £10 million in the UK, which is some going for a UK film.
It's simply just far too adequate to still be hanging around in the top 10.
Scott, tap away. Can you find out how that compares to the gross for something like Hot Fuzz? Because I've got a horrible feeling that despite being a much better film, Hot Fuzz probably didn't take as much money at the UK box office as Run, Fat Boy, Run.
It took about 21 million UK in its total run.
Oh, shut up then. I'm only out by a factor of two. I found it largely unremarkable. I mean, I didn't loathe it or anything like that. It served a purpose reasonably well, but I'm certainly not going to bother to buy it, or even if I see it on the cheap, it was very much disposable fun for 90 minutes and nothing else. So
it's got all that kind of ITV miniseries feel to it, isn't it?
Two-part across
a weekend on a wet Wednesday afternoon or something, I don't know.
I'm sure the next time I come across it will be in about 2 years' time when it's the BBC One Christmas premiere sort of thing, you know, and otherwise I doubt our paths will ever cross again. Speaking of which, at number seven we have the intellectual monolith of Resident Evil 3.
Why, dear God, why?
Help me! Resident Evil 3, in which Mila Jovovich continues to look lovely and of very little worth other than that. Am I wrong?
No.
You're right.
It's terrible and should be avoided, as with the rest of the series.
Looking forward to number four, boys.
Oh, can't wait.
Yes.
Now, come on, I have this theory that as long as it centres on that bloke who plays Albert Wesker, it's going to be fantastic. It's going to be camp beyond camp.
Albert Wesker's acting was on a par with the original PlayStation game. I was so impressed by how bad that was.
Oh, well, in that sense, the guy's such an accurate mimic. Surely there's an Oscar nomination in there for him. Oh, why can't they see the genius? Number six, we have the latest from the Farrelly brothers in combination with What's-His-Face, The Heartbreak Kid.
Yeah. What's-His-Face for this film, I think, played by Ben Stiller.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And it's basically Farley and Stiller doing pretty much their usual thing. Ben Stiller jumps into a marriage with a whirlwind romance far too quickly, finds out that they're really on the honeymoon, they're in no way compatible, and by the magic of films, he also meets a girl on the same resort who turns out to be the woman of her dreams. Thus, farce and conflict and, well, I guess hopefully humour, but there's not an awful lot of that in this film. Ooh. It's not great, if we're being brutally honest.
Drew, what were your feelings on the subject?
I've not seen it, so I have none.
Do you want to cast any unfounded aspersions?
No. I'm investing no emotion in it at all. I have no interest in it, and I don't even think it'll be bad enough to make up reviews of having not seen it.
Your lack of vitriol this week disappoints me, sir. At number five, we have a film that dragged on and on and on called Rendition. Scott, what saith ye?
I really have to talk about this film.
You do, sir.
It's just a very boring experience for everyone concerned. The basic plot of it is, I'm sure everyone's well aware by now, is a guy with a foreign name gets on a plane in South Africa, going to back home to the US, but he is suspected somewhat of being maybe kind of sort of involved in some terrorist plot, maybe, and he's got a foreign name. So let's whack him off the plane, send him off to a godforsaken hellhole and torture him until we get some information out of him, which of course is the now fairly famous practice of rendition, which is everyone's been up in arms about. As a film, you've basically got the fella's wife, Reese Witherspoon, trying to work out what's going on, where he is, so on and so forth, with some silly subplot about the fella doing the torturing's daughter as relationship with someone else who's getting involved in extremism. And it's just extraordinarily dull. I mean, there's long, long stretches where nothing happens. I suppose you mentioned Jake Gyllenhaal is the CIA agent overseeing this little torture operation who has a crisis of conscience and tries to make things right in the end.
He does seem a little fresh-faced and young to be a sort of responsible for that kind of thing, doesn't he? That was the impression I got.
Yeah, he does.
I don't want to, you know, denounce his acting capabilities, because we all know he's a very capable young actor, but not that he was out of his depth, he just felt miscast to me. I know, Drew, you haven't seen Rendition, have you?
No.
No, I went to see it, and as I was explaining to you guys earlier on, my mark of a film, how much I enjoyed the film, is gauged by the discomfort of my feet at any one given point during the film. If I'm too busy thinking about the fact my feet feel like they're inflamed, it means I'm not really enjoying it, and I missed a good half hour of Rendition because I was too busy fidgeting in my feet, saying, oh, God, my feet are annoying me. So... Yeah. It's very worthy, but not entertaining really in any sense of the word.
I'm not sure I'd even say that. I mean, it does a great job of avoiding any sort of attempt at any sort of justification for the process of rendition by having all these CIA bigwigs, notably Meryl Streep, going around being so evil they're practically twirling their moustaches and cackling manically.
Yeah, that's true, actually. At the point at which Meryl Streep basically says, we don't do torture, the United States doesn't do torture. It's like, no, you just have a different name for it.
Yeah.
Still the same thing.
We've called it something slightly else.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like, I mean, occasionally you hear right wings people blathering on about, oh, Hollywood liberals, yada, yada, yada. And this is, you can kind of see their point when they come up with a drivel like this.
Yeah, this is just ammunition in their cannon, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like a lot of these issue movies, it's pretty much a terrible film in itself, and it's only people having any sort of traction behind it by the fact that it's about a controversial subject.
To me, it seems far too focused. It's too preoccupied with trying to feel worthy that it actually misses having a point.
Yeah, it's just overbearingly preachy and about a tenth as intelligent and relevant as it thinks it is. I mean, if you've been paying any sort of attention to world news whatsoever, you'll have thought about this, what, a good 2 years ago or something, when the last sort of controversy kicked up about it, and this is just far too late to have any kind of impact, unless, of course, you get all your information about the world from movies, in which case you're a bit odd.
As far as I'm concerned, it's so out of date now that if someone mentions to me sort of, you know, dodgy plane flights, orange jumpsuits, I immediately just think of EasyJet and not Rendition. At number four, something far more promising in name and calibre, Eastern Promises, the latest from David Cronenberg, and something of a companion piece to A History of Violence. I haven't seen it yet, lads, but what did you make of it?
Well, it's a companion piece to History of Violence in that it's David Cronenberg very much moving into being a very adept at the slow-burning thriller. I must admit, I was very disappointed that a film called Eastern Promises wasn't once about Fry's Turkish Delight, as all those 1980s adverts would suggest.
Damn. It's been mismarketed. You've been sold a lemon, Drew.
I know, it should have had chocolate coating, pink gelatinous stuff in the middle, and a panther in the advert.
That's it. Someone chopping it in half with a scimitar or something like that.
Should we perhaps talk about what it's about, or should we just talk about Turkish Delight?
Yeah, well, Drew and I can focus more on the chocolate, but while we do, you fill us in, Scott.
Well, basically, a young girl dies during labour, and a midwife who's played by Naomi Watts for some reason decides to become a policewoman rather than just handing the matter over to the authorities. She decides to track down the location of the surviving relatives of this girl, take the baby off to somewhere suitable, and turns out not to be a great idea as he winds up becoming rather embroiled with the Russian mafia.
Duh.
Which is not particularly what you'd want to do.
Well, at least she was making an effort. We're always complaining in Britain at the moment that nurses don't seem to be, you know, given very much to do, really. So,
yeah.
You know, at least she's being proactive.
So, yeah, involved in the underworld. That's always a bonus.
What misadventures do her investigations end up embroiling her in, Scott?
Well, largely she winds up connecting the girl to the seemingly a respectable restaurant owner, but actually the kingpin of the Russian mafia in London, and his son, played by Vincent Cassell, and also Viggo Mortensen, who you've seen doing this terrible accent in all the trailers so far. So, yeah, it's more concerned, really, I guess, with Viggo Mortensen and his adventures in the Russian underworld, which get quite violent at places. If you're going to say it's a companion piece to History of Violence, I suppose it's mainly because of the way it's structured. You have long periods of very tense, sort of very edgy performances, followed by the odd moment of fairly shocking violence before sort of getting back into this kind of cratching up the tension, and it's just done so well.
I'd say I haven't seen the film. I have seen the majority of it, but I don't feel qualified to comment on it because I haven't technically seen the whole film yet. But I have witnessed a couple of the key violent moments, the sauna scene which everyone's talking about, and the garrotting as well. Drew, how does this compare on a visceral level? I mean, the violence in the History of Violence was quite shocking, and in an age where it's quite difficult to unsettle people with violence, David Cronenberg managed it. Is this a step further beyond again?
I would say it's a step further. It's on a similar level, but it does achieve something in that you do get shocked. You do think, ooh, you know, that's brutal, as opposed to pretty much anything else you watch, you're entirely desensitised to.
Well, exactly, this is it. It's quite an accolade in that sense. I mean, a lot of films these days, I see puff pieces by directors on, you know, on DVD extras saying, oh, the violence in this film, I wanted it to be real and have a point. And you sit there and watch it and you think, oh, you know what, I'm completely unaffected by it. But David Cronenberg seems to have mastered the art of actually making violence genuinely unsettling in an age where, as you say, we have been completely desensitised to it.
Yeah, but he managed to do it too without it being sort of simply voyeuristic or in any way entertaining. It's the violence occurs and you think, ugh, and then you think, yeah, I can believe that there are people out there. These are really nasty people. People you wouldn't want anything to do with. That's why they have the reputation they do. And he managed to convey that sort of thing on screen.
Yeah, sorry, Scott, on you go.
No, I was just saying, you've got to give plaudits to Viggo Mortensen, despite it does sound a bit like the Count off Sesame Street, but it's a great performance. You do feel like you know quite a lot about this character. I mean, he doesn't say an awful lot. He doesn't really reveal an awful lot about his past or what goes on, but you do feel like you've got a fairly intimate understanding of what drives him by the end of it, which is quite strange for a very, I suppose it's more of a physical performance rather than anything that's actually said.
What I'm interested in finding out your opinion, both you guys, on is that for me, I very much enjoyed A History of Violence. I feel I may not have enjoyed it as much as some other people and you guys, in that while it was an excellent film, for me it was a little bit too detached from reality. I couldn't connect with it as much as I would have liked to, although I did very much enjoy it. Is Eastern Promises more grounded in reality, or is it still I'm loath to say far-fetched, but do you understand what I mean when I say that a history of violence wasn't necessarily 100% believable?
I think I do understand what you mean, but certainly Eastern Promises, you couldn't really have the same concern, because it's been very thoroughly researched by the screenwriter, particularly Stephen Knight, I think he is. He's did a lot of research into it. He must have quite a thorough understanding of the London underworld too, because he also wrote the screenplay for Dirty Pretty Things, which was about illegal workers in London.
Yes, yeah.
Illegal organ donation, that sort of thing. But he's done research, spoken to the Russian desk at Scotland Yard. And I saw an interview with him where he was speaking to, he said he'd been speaking to a charity, an anti-slavery charity, who say that there are now, they estimate there are now more people in slavery in this year, 2007, than there were in the 18th century.
That's incredible.
It's fine, but obviously with one of the main points of the film being about human trafficking.
Yeah.
He's done his research and it seems to be that it's quite accurate, and that the violence, the violent world these people live in, is fairly accurately represented.
I can see that perhaps History of Violence is something of a contrivance with the way the lead character is, you know, like a massively competent gangster, but he's, you know, pretending to be a normal life and all that kind of thing, which is a bit contrived, whereas this is just full of nasty people doing nasty things and is perfectly believable because there's quite enough evidence of nasty people doing nasty things in the news all the time. So it's
just absolutely
watching any day. You can see, yep, those people exist. They're all around us, unfortunately.
And where, in this case, in your opinion, then, where does this rank alongside History of Violence? Is this a better overall film, or does it lack as a work of art? Or
I would, it's at least equal, and I'd say probably slightly better than it, purely because it does feel a bit more real, if you'll pardon the street urbanism.
Yeah, I'd say I felt largely the same. They're both excellent films. Possibly Eastern Promises just edges, simply because you think it's a bit more unsettling, because you think there's people out there, there's every chance that you might actually bump into these people. Not saying that you'd get involved in their world, but it's kind of a frightening thought to think you could just walk past these people on the street.
Yeah.
It's sort of a remarkable thing. If you'd came to me 10 years ago and said that David Cronenberg, of all people, would be doing the most tightly wound thrillers that you can see in a cinema, I'd laugh in your face. I mean, I figured his lasting contribution to pop culture would be the mention in Wayne's World where they make reference to that scene in Scanners where the dude's head blows up.
Exactly. Or people having videotapes pushed into their stomachs and things.
Lots of props that look like vaginas. That seemed to be more or less what he was going for. Then all of a sudden it's like, well, I've done enough of that. Let's do some proper films for a change.
Well, he's very much, you know, there is this genre which people refer to called body horror, and he seems to be both the man who invented it and the only person working in it. But he's, for me, a lot of his films, I have enjoyed several films, including things like Scanners and Naked Lunch, but I can appreciate that these aren't necessarily accessible to the more of a mass market. And the success of A History of Violence came as quite a pleasant surprise to me, because I feel like this is a guy who's been doing very worthy work, but maybe hasn't had the recognition on a wider scale, and now he's achieving that. But at the same time, there is the feeling that that band that you discovered first, or, you know, that author whose books you were raving about before anyone else heard about him, he's sort of been taken away from you a little bit, hasn't it?
I remember watching Videodrome at 2 o'clock in the morning on BBC Two and yada, that sort of thing.
When I was five.
I still remember it being presented by Alex Cox. It was terrible.
But if there's one person who you don't begrudge it to, it's got to be... has the man actually ever made a bad film?
I'd probably put Existence in the bad film category.
It's one of the few films of his I haven't actually seen.
I think it at best struggles its way up to mediocre, but it's quite fundamentally flawed.
Yeah. It's, well, fundamentally flawed for me because it's got Jude Law in it, but hey. Drew, what do you feel... I can't remember the question I was going to ask you. Just what do you feel, Drew?
Electrical impulse. He's transmitted along my nerves and interpreted in my brain is largely what I feel, Craig.
Do you know what? I'm glad to hear that. At number three, we have... At number three, we have Stardust, a joint US. Is it joint US UK or is it just UK?
Joint US UK.
Joint US UK. I was going to say sci-fi. It's more of a fantasy endeavour. Directed by. Do you know I'm so well prepared tonight? Directed by your fella,
Matthew Vaughn.
Your fella, What Done Layer Cake, and adapted from the Neil. That's it. And adapted from a Neil Gaiman novel by none other than her waters, him off the telly's wife.
Yes, Jane Goldman.
Succinctly,
wife yes. Jonathan Woss.
That's it. I don't like to be too concise because I like people to, you know, I credit people with the intelligence to fill in the blanks themselves.
You're that's helping them help themselves.
Exactly. That's my excuse and I'm sticking to it. I'm almost ashamed to say that Stardust was a little bit of a guilty pleasure for me. I can't deny that I enjoyed it. I felt it was a little bit clunky around the edges, and you'd expect that from a sort of British film. I feel marginally embarrassed by it as a piece of national filmmaking, but hey, it set out to entertain, and it did reasonably well, I think. What did you guys think?
Well, I really, really liked it, actually. I've no real complaints with it at all, apart from a few minutes. There's some clunky dialogue, but having read the book, I think it's actually a far better film than it is a book. Basic stories of kind of standard fairy tale thing. You've got Tristan, Charlie Cox, who I don't think I've seen before. I'm sure he must have been in something, but I don't recall seeing this actor in anything before. Trying to win Sienna Miller's heart, which I don't know why you'd want to do that, by crossing the wall to a fairy tale land where all sorts of crazy things happen, mainly a star falls from the sky. You want to retrieve that to win Sienna's heart. The star turns out to be Claire Danes.
It's the easiest way, isn't it?
Well, it's normally what you do, isn't it? It's either that or the milk tree.
Milk tree's just cheap, man.
And but other people after her, there's the evil witch Lamia by Michelle Pfeiffer, which wants to find the star, cut out her heart, and regain youth and eternal life. And there's a couple of prospective kings of Stormhold trying to find the girl as well for one of the trinkets she's carrying about. So there's a... turns into pretty much the usual kind of chase quest.
And there's also Robert De Niro as a camp pirate.
Which is clearly the highlight of the film.
I should say
I would say actually that would come second. I think the highlight and one of the problems I had with the film is that it's a little too long. Although I'd happily keep the running time and exchange it for an extra 15 minutes of Peter O'Toole laughing at his son's demise. Because that was awesome.
Oh, Tool, you old cad.
And that had to be the highlight of the film for me. That was deeply entertaining for some twisted reason. There's probably something wrong with me that I found that quite so entertaining, but...
No, I can agree with you, actually, in a sick way.
Well, what I find quite odd about this film is that I think I agree that it is too long, yet at the same time, I felt like it could do with slowing down a bit more. There's a fairly rich kind of world that they've invented here. There's lots of sort of nice touches into it, but it feels like it's just not concentrating on them and kind of cracking on with some kind of misguided plot and just having people run around between various places where it could
one wacky
take
character
it.
After another.
I had the same feeling, Scott. I remember thinking, watching it. There were a few bits that it just felt like it was ambling along. It's very meandering. Then other bits, particularly when the first time you see Robert De Niro's ship, yeah. I'm thinking, well, look at the design they've put into that. And then you're just thinking, I'm suddenly thinking, man, there's too much here. You know, it's just one film, you're cramming too much in, and I can't quite reconcile one feeling with the other. It should be entirely mutually incompatible. But I managed to feel that it was too much and too little in at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, it's certainly more worthwhile of your £7 than the film which is at number 2 in our chart, and that would be Saw 4, which, well, I can't really cast an opinion on because I haven't seen it, but I'm not beyond that sort of thing. It's probably shit. Yeah, Scott, what do you think?
Well, sadly, I have seen it, and I'll confirm your analysis that it is shit.
Oh, good.
Although, coming from someone that's never saw much attraction Saw in the first place, the series has just been going through a series of diminishing returns from the first one, and this one's clearly the bottom of the barrel. Apparently, death hasn't stopped Jigsaw, the serial-killing boogeyman of the piece. They find another tape hidden in his body while cutting him up for a autopsy.
they what?
He took a small tape with a kind of usual cassette tape that he'd been doing, dipped it in wax and swallowed it. It is revealed later in the film, sometime before he died while he's still in hospital. Thus, when they're cutting him open and taking him apart, they found another tape and the games start again. And this one's incredibly silly. It has a copper called Rig, who apparently is played by Lyric Bent. I'm not saying anything about that name. He's looking for, fairly obsessively, for Eric Matthews, Donnie Wahlberg from the second film. Mm-hmm. He has a is basically drawn into another little game where he has to go through watching of a variety of silly traps and the usual sort of Saw nonsense. And there's a couple of FBI agents following along behind him for largely plot exposition reasons, as far as I can tell. You know, to sort of, well, Jigsaw must be doing this, yada yada, and sort of enabling the next set piece to be set up. And it makes very, very little sense. They seem to have gone with the notion that most people are watching this film purely to see people getting cut up in a variety of ways, and they don't need to bother having any kind of coherent plot to tie it all together anymore. So that's what they just run with. There's bits in here that aren't really connected to anything else. There's usual sort of daft traps and people getting their heads chopped into bits and all that kind of thing, and it's just risible.
Is it at least inventively gruesome?
Not really.
Boo.
There's only so many times you can watch someone's head to get, you know, smashed between two slabs of ice or something like that, and simply not good enough.
Under what circumstances is that a convenient trap to set up?
I don't think any of the traps have ever been convenient.
They've always been a bit overly elaborate, haven't they? And sort of, hang on, has this guy got a degree in engineering?
Mm-hmm.
Where does he get these things from?
Actually, he does have a degree in engineering. This is possibly the thing that annoyed me most about this is it's going quite heavily into Jigsaw's backstory from before he became the mass murdering psychopath. Now, if you're going to try and build sympathy for a character, it's normally wise to do that before you've made him into, you know, the absolute boogeyman. And I'm just not going to care about anything that happens to him in his pre-crazy days because, you know, he's crazy, a crazy nut job who's killed 18,000 people or whatever it is by this point in the film. I don't know if it's just people like Tobin Bell or something, I don't know. But
he has got a great name.
Great name. He's not a particularly great actor, and that's something else that plagues the film.
What do you mean? Great names are synonymous with great acting ability.
Well, I think the worst actor in it is one of Riggs' friends, Hoffman, who's played by Costas Mandalore, which is
excellent.
I think it's an excellent name, but he's a terrible actor.
That is an excellent name.
The whole thing is the one trick pony is people get killed, but people don't get killed particularly impressively, so it's not much of a trick pony anymore.
No. Drew, have you seen Saw 4?
I certainly have not, and resent the implication.
You have my most sincere apologies. And that leaves us with the number one film at the UK boxes. It is number one at the boxes, before anybody says. It's also number one at the box office, and that is Ratatouille, which I still haven't caught up with. CG, Pixar, Rat in a Kitchen, What Am Me Gonna Do? Scott, what's the plot?
Well, we've already spoken about this in some depth last time, so I won't prose over it, but that's more or less it. There's a rat in a kitchen who wants to be a cook and stumbles along in mildly entertaining Pixar way. Then it sort of crashes to a halt and it's okay. No real issues with it. It's fine, but it's Pixar by the numbers.
Does it have a rosy ending? Does he get to be a cook?
No, he's actually caught up in a brutal trap. It's quite sad, really.
Excellent. I may catch up with that then. I fear you're telling me fibs. Well, everybody, thanks for entertaining us, or allowing us to entertain you, hopefully, for another however many minutes this fortnight. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and hopefully we'll be speaking to you again soon. I've been Craig Eastman, for what it's worth, and it's goodbye from me and from Scott.
Goodbye.
And from Drew.
Goodbye.
I'll see you soon.
I have no clue what was going on in that at all.